From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. Former U.S. Senator Slade Gorton casts a long shadow in Washington state politics. The former attorney general and U.S. senator has been in politics in our state for 50 years. Today, Slade Gorton is a lawyer, a lobbyist, a foundation member, a political strategist. There's a new biography by John C. Hughes out, published by the Washington State Heritage Center and the Slade Gorton International Policy Center. Welcome, and thank you for coming by.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here.
Your dad ran Gorton's of Gloucester, the seafood company that everyone from back east knows for Gorton's fish sticks. And I understand he really wanted you to join the company,
Actually, it was my grandfather,
who
ran that. My father thought he would run it, but it was lost to the banks
in
the mid-1920s. And my father left and started his own fish company in Chicago, Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I grew up. And yes, he did want me to succeed him, and it's named to this day the Slade Gorton Company.
And he really, you really did not want to do that. Why not?
Very early on, I decided that I wanted to do something other than be in the fish business with my life. And maybe it was starting to work there when I was 12 years old, all day long on Saturday, helping load and unload trucks and, working with frozen fish. It just did not seem to me to be the life that my father thought it would be.
I think it's your brother who tells a story about a very heated discussion between you and your father about whether you would be in it or not, and you turned around to walk out the door, and what happened then?
I don't remember that part of the story.
It says in the story, maybe you don't remember this, it says this in the story that your father took a baseball and like threw it at you.
I think that's probably true. It was my great good fortune that my next brother, and I have two younger brothers, fit into it perfectly. Went through business school at Dartmouth, went to work for my father the day after he finished, and is still there.
Slade Gorton, you're known as a pretty smart guy, but you were accepted at Yale and Stanford, and you said no to both of them. How did that happen?
Yale and Stanford law schools.
Yes.
After I went to college.
Yes.
I was very undirected, other than knowing that I didn't want to go into the fish business in my senior year in college. I was accepted at both of those schools. I was an Easterner then, or a Midwesterner. I had no idea I'd ever live in the West, and so Stanford just seemed a long, long way away. And I can hardly remember why it was that I turned down the acceptance to Yale Law School, but I changed my mind very rapidly during the course of the summer after I was actually out of college and faced with the prospect of actually getting a job, turned around and did go to law school, finished at Columbia, and it was during that period of time, actually during my last year at Columbia, that I decided to come west and picked Seattle as a place to which to come.
Yeah, you obviously changed your mind about the West. You arrived in Seattle, it says, in 1953 at the Greyhound bus station, still in the same location, with $300. Why Seattle?
Partly, it was an exploration that a couple of junior faculty members from Columbia had made the summer before to all of the western states and writing about them. Partly it was the fact that the largest law firm in Seattle then had 30 lawyers in it, was much smaller than was the case in San Francisco and Los Angeles. Partly it was the fact that Seattle was on the water, and I'd always lived near near the water. And partly it was the inspiration of the 1952 National Republican Convention, the very last convention of either party in which you did not know who the nominee was going to be when the convention started, between Eisenhower and Taft. And the principal speaker on the principal issue for Eisenhower was a young state senator from the Tacoma area named Don Eastbold, who impressed me tremendously while I was watching that convention in Massachusetts between my second and third years of law school. And as much as anything else, that example said, of all those places out west, Seattle must be the best.
Slade Gorton, as long as I've been here in this area, you're sort of thought of as a conservative. So I was very interested to see earlier in your political career, you and Joel Pritchard and Dan Evans and others were the progressive Republicans.
Well, I think that that was the case then and that that's the case now within the Republican Party. The best of all of the rating organizations on members of the Senate would usually rank me about maybe 10th, 12th, or 14th from the left to the right among Republican senators, which would put me in the dead center of the Senate. Mm-hmm.
At that time, it was a pivotal, what you called a pivotal moment in your political career, and you did something that had your critics said you were defending a commie. What was that incident in your life, and why was it so pivotal to you?
I had served in the State House of Representatives with a Democratic state representative from the Okanagan country named John Goldmark. He had come west, in a sense, as I did, but had come west to be a rancher with his family from New York City, though he was a graduate, I think, of Harvard Law School. I found him to be intriguing. I found him to be very smart. I found I enjoyed debating him on Republican versus Democratic issues in the legislature more than I did anyone else. And after we served two terms in the House together, he was opposed in his next primary election by the very far right, by the remains of the John Birch Society, but by what was a very significant, very conservative element in the Democratic Party. And effectively, they called him a communist. They beat him badly. I mean, it wasn't even a close election. And he turned around and sued the people who had caused his loss for libel at a time at which that was something that could seriously be considered. And I was asked to testify as to his reputation. And it was a pivotal moment because I knew two things. I knew that if I said no, I'd regard myself as a coward. I knew if I said yes, I'd get myself in political trouble at home. I ended up saying yes. It's the first time I ever set foot in Okanagan County. He won the lawsuit, ultimately lost it when the U.S. Supreme Court said, in effect, that politicians can't be libeled. The consequence was that I had one of the offshoots of the people who ran against him run against me in the next primary election in Northeast Seattle. Well, Northeast Seattle was very different from Okanagan County. I ended up winning the race, but it was a very prominent race for a legislative primary. And in a sense, it made my career.
Well, another time that you tacked against the mainstream was when you were attorney general. It was during the Watergate scandal. And you stood up before a Republican, fairly conservative crowd at the Seattle Rotary, and you called for President Nixon to step down. How did that go down with your audience and with other people at that time?
It was the downtown Seattle Rotary Club, which was, I think, essentially at the time, and to a certain extent still is, the downtown business establishment. And I solicited the opportunity to speak to them because I felt very firmly about it that, that President Nixon had let down his country and had let down his political party, and that at that point, which was 6 months, I think, at least 6 months before his resignation, at that point was subject to being impeached on the basis of his own story, that you didn't have to make a judgment as to what the facts were. You could accept just what was out and was undisputed. And I felt that he should go. And I was attorney general of the state of Washington, the chief law enforcement officer. And it seemed to me appropriate to say so. And I did. It did create a considerable furor, I may say. One county Republican organization formally expelled me from the party. But then 6 months later, when he left, people said, "What did you know that I didn't know?"
Slate Gorton, thank you so much for coming by. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mel Sheldon is chairman of the board of the Tulalip tribe, but he wasn't always in politics. Chairman Sheldon fished for 25 years. He worked as a houseboy at two University of Washington sororities. And before that, Sheldon served as a pilot in Vietnam. Chairman Sheldon says he likes life on the edge, he likes being busy, and he likes working hard. Today, meet Chairman Mel Sheldon to find out how he got to where he is today. Mel Sheldon, thank you so much for coming down. We really appreciate you taking some time out from your day to be with us.
Well, thank you very much, and it truly is an honor to be here with you today, Ross.
Did you, as a young man, as a boy, aspire to be chairman of the Tulalip tribe? Is this something you've always wanted to do?
Well, no, that was really not on the radar back then. I was thinking back the other day. In third grade, I was reading some books about Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig, and I wanted to be a New York Yankee. I wanted to wear the pinstripes.
Now, I read that you grew up on the reservation until you were five, and you left after your parents split up after that.
That's right.
Did you always feel strongly associated with the tribe as a young person?
Yes, sir. Mom made darn sure that we understood that we were Native American. We were Tulalip, as well as Sisseton Wahpeton Sioux Indian. And she made sure that we came down to Tulalip to visit our family and relatives as much as she could.
What parts of the culture did she kind of impress upon you to make sure that you still felt part of it? I mean, she took you there, but what else?
I think it was stressing family.
Yeah.
Family, the family values, that these are your cousins, this is where you belong. And it stayed with me through the years. And whether I knew it or not, someday I was going to find my way back to the reservation.
Now, you went to Vietnam right out of high school and served in the service, and you were a pilot. What kind of a pilot? What were you flying?
Well, I flew a Hughes 500. It was a reconnaissance helicopter, and I flew with the 1st Cav, 1st and 9th. And the missions I flew were, we called them hunter-killer missions. So I would go out with a Cobra, a gunship. We'd go out to an area. Then I would drop out of altitude down to the deck, and I would fly at treetop level looking for any kind of data, intelligence, trails, hooches, anything to report back to company headquarters. As it went on, we actually carried the fight right down there.
You were a teenager at that time?
19 years old.
19. Wow. Well, you must have been one of the youngest pilots doing that?
I think 19 was an earlier age to arrive doing that. Most of the average age of pilots, as I learned later, was about 23 years old. So,
now, a lot of soldiers had a tough time returning from Vietnam, and I guess you're no exception.
Right.
What happened when you returned?
Well, there was obviously some challenges. I didn't quite know what to do with the experience I just had. And, I turned to education as one solution, trying to find out why we have a foreign policy that has wars like that. And also to find out about Native American history, things like that, that education served me well on going to junior college and then eventually to the University of Washington.
Yeah, and you studied political science. You went to Skagit College and later the UW. At that time, there was the nation was in a furor over the Vietnam War.
Yes.
As a veteran going to the UW campus at the time, where there was obviously a lot of opposition, did you ever feel that?
It was tough. I wanted to feel so proud of serving our country. But it wasn't there for whatever reason. Our country was divided. And I wanted to feel so proud of it. So I had to take those feelings and put them on the side and continue life and move forward. It was through the help of family and friends and other Vietnam veterans that I could keep moving forward. Although, I'll tell you, the experience was, I will always cherish my time in Vietnam. As I tell a lot of people, it was a lot of fun when I wasn't scared.
Do you still keep up with people you served with?
Yes. Through the internet, my unit has a website. Mm-hmm. And so all of us served with the Charlie Troop 1st and 9th. We keep track from 66 on until we went home in 71. My unit went home. I went to other unit and flew. But we keep track of each other. The brotherhood is still there today.
Mel Sheldon is my guest. He's chairman of the board of the Tulalip tribe. You came back and you used your GI benefits to go to college and learn about management and learn about political science. But while you were at the university, I understand you had kind of an unusual job. You were working at a sorority?
Yes, sir. It was a tough job. Somebody had to do it. But I had the GI Bill to work with and tuition. And so, yes, getting 3 squares a day and a little bit of a check at the end of the month was it was just right. And, working, I got to see the Greek system from a different point of view. And some of the friendships I made at working at the Kappa Kappa Gamma House still holds today. I'm in contact with them, and it's such an honor to have worked there.
Were all the other guys jealous that you were working at this sorority?
Well, they wondered what it was like, and I had a lot of fun through the years sharing the stories of going up to the third floor and changing a light bulb, mm-hmm. and every morning looking at 80 young ladies coming for breakfast in their hair and curlers and things of that nature. But it was a great experience.
You began your professional life working for a telephone company. You were kind of working your way up in the management, and then you ditched all that to go fishing. How did you come to that decision?
Well, I started out fishing in 73. My mother had moved to Ketchikan, and so she got me a job there. And I worked on a purse seiner for 3 or 4 years, and then went back to finish my degree at the UW. And my uncle came to me one day. I was working for General Telephone as a telephone operator. And he says, "Nephew, I've got a job for you." And I knew that a purse seiner in the right hands could make a lot of money as a deckhand. So I said, I put the corporate career on hold, so to speak, and went fishing. And doggone if I didn't stay there for a few years.
Well, a lot of attraction to fishing because you probably didn't need to work all year round. You could make your money in part of the year and take the rest of the year off. I know a lot of fishermen did that.
Exactly. And working, that was augmenting the later years when I went to further schooling, going fishing and then going to school. It was a great 1-2 combination.
Of course, fishing has been a huge tradition in the Native American community. And back in 74, there was this giant decision that affected tribes here in Washington State, the Bolt decision. And it said that the 1850s treaties that the government had signed with these tribes proved that the Native Americans were entitled to half the salmon and steelhead harvest in their traditional fishing grounds. And this was hugely controversial. Slade Gorton, who later became senator, fought it as attorney general. And I'm wondering how that affected your tribe, the Tulalip tribe. Did you have a lot of usual and accustomed places that now people could fish from and actually make a living at it?
Absolutely. It was one of the great decisions that helped all of the tribes here in the Northwest that have fishing rights in the saltwater. And what it did is it brought further identity to who we are, that now we could go out and fish. Now, the challenge there was is, did we give away 50% of the fish? Should we have gotten 100%? But that's left for a different day and a different conversation. Mm-hmm. But as we moved forward from 74 on, yes, it was a big battle. Slade was just never really bought into it, that we have treaty rights that guaranteed fishing rights and the opportunity for a generation to go out and have an occupation, a viable occupation, and to feed their families and to be proud of our culture and who we are, as well as our treaty rights were upheld. We were very proud of that.
I think a lot, there may still be people who resent that. There are some people, store owners near reservations, who resent the fact that you're able to go there and not have to pay the same kind of taxes on a reservation, mm-hmm. Resent the fact that the rules are different. And I think there's kind of a fundamental misunderstanding about this being special privileges versus the fact that Native American tribes are sovereign. And maybe you could just explain that. What does that mean?
Well, the sovereignty part is guaranteed through treaties and upheld by different court decisions that we are a government. We are an actual government. And whether it be talking to the city of Marysville or to Snohomish County, or just the other day I was speaking with the Governor Jay Inslee, and we both acknowledge that we are government sitting at a peer level, government to government conversations. And Booth Gardner, memorial for him the other day as he passed on, continued his journey. He was the first governor that started our centennial accords with the tribes, acknowledging us at that state level. And we would come together and meet with them. And the President Obama and other preceding presidents do meet once a year with the tribal leaders across the nation back in D.C. So that acknowledgement of a treaty sovereignty, of who we are as a legal government, is so important.
The other giant thing along with the Bolt decision are the Native American casinos, and you have a casino at the Tulalip tribe. How has that changed the tribe?
Well, you're right. We do have a little bed and breakfast along I-5 there up just north of Mary.
You're being modest.
Putting a little plug in for our Tulalip Resort casino there. What it has done is, as fishing has receded, and we will always be fisher people. That's a given. That's our culture. That's our history. But now you have another occupation and enterprise, goodwill that came our way to employ people, to provide livable wages for not only that individual, but their family, too, to be there. It has so many benefits that came our way, and we're very, very fortunate.
Any downside of casinos on your reservation? And some people associate gambling with other bad side effects. Have you noticed any?
No. As a matter of fact, early on in the compact, there was a community impact, a 2% kind of that came from table games that we would donate to the negative impact experienced by cities or counties or whoever. There was no negative impacts. It was all a positive impact. And so the tribe, in their own way, continued to give that 2% out as a goodwill gesture. So it has been a real positive impact. Today, Tulalip employs close to 3,500 direct employment, and 80% of that is non-tribal. So we are doing our best to be in this economic canoe with our larger community.
Now, this brings up a kind of another interesting thing about Native American sovereignty, and that's the fact that you have your own court system. Is that right? Could you just explain that a little bit? Why do you think it's important for Native Americans to have their own court system?
Well, I think it is another expression of sovereignty, a community that we have our own police force or department. We have our own judicial system. Many cities, counties are measured by those two departments or those approaches. At Tulalip, what really is special about our court system is, as you may know, the recent legislation, the VAWA, that the president signed, Violence Against Women Act, having a legitimate court system is a very important part of the legislation. So when a crime of violence is committed against a Native woman by a non-tribal, they can be held accountable in our judicial system.
And up until now, they were not.
They were not.
How about someone else committing another crime on the reservation? Are they prosecuted in a tribal court, or are they sent to a county court?
Well, previously, they could go, it would go, depending on the crime, go to a county court or elsewhere. But we are trying to improve, and we are improving our court efficiencies, and that it is a level playing field so that anybody can come in and they will receive a fair hearing. They may not believe it, but they will.
Mel Shelton, thank you so much for coming in. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Well, thank you very much, and it's just an honor to speak with you, Ross.
Mel is chairman of the board of the Tulalip tribe, and he's a Vietnam vet, a fisherman, former sorority houseboy, and perhaps future motorcycle rider. He might be doing that after he retires.
David Hyde produces The Conversation with Arwin Nix. We get production help from Allie Ferguson. Bernard Ouellette is our engineer. I'm Ross Reynolds, and this is KUOW 94.9 Seattle.